Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. Come on home, baby. And now, your host, Gary Null. Oh,
come on home. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have so much to share, always starting with the latest on health and healing and how we can live a longer and more enlightened life. Then continuing a six-part series on understanding everything that is relevant and honest about the debate involving vaccines. Not just should we be giving mandatory vaccines like Gardasil or the MMR or the flu vaccine, but do they work? What is the proof they work? What is the proof they do not work? What is the proof they're safe or not safe? And we are using Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. In part one, she talked about her own background as a very orthodox, mainstream physician with impeccable credentials, professor of medicine, working at a teaching hospital, publishing, a kidney specialist, an internist, and how all that made a difference when it came to examining the truth about vaccines and how she was shocked. And then she did between 3,000 to 5,000 hours of research, reviewing every single study on vaccine safety and efficacy, to find that, as she said, quote, there are no safe or effective vaccines, certainly not effective as far as any given person. So we're going to be exploring that in depth every day this week. For those who want to know the truth, you'll get it. Then we have an interesting discussion coming up with two people, Robert Kennedy Jr. live today, and Robert Krakow, one of the top trial attorneys and working on vaccine-damaged children through the government's Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And here's the issue, the real hidden agenda behind mandatory vaccines, the CDC, Big Pharma, and the vaccine cartels. So today we are setting the record straight. Now, why are we doing this? Because right now there is a national push in the mainstream media to make sure that vaccines are imprinted in people's minds as safe and effective, and adults should be vaccinated now, they're saying. And they're trying to get mandatory adult vaccines. So that's what we're doing. So that's our program today. And as you see, we have a lot to do. Let's begin. Let's begin with the idea that we have an epidemic of cancer in the United States, both cancer and precancer. Remember, it might take 20, 30, 40 years of having precancer before you have the actual cancer. So we have been using chemotherapy on almost all cancers with terrible results. In fact, we know, and it's been proven and published, that chemotherapy and radiation both are carcinogenic. They cause cancer. So let's just say that you're looking for a more natural approach. And shouldn't you be using the non-toxic and natural approaches that build up the body's immune system before you go to the more severe therapies? According to Sayer G of GreenMed Info, every once in a while a study happens that goes up on the National Library of Medicine. That's the government's official good science archives. So when something is published in the National Library of Medicine, it's considered completely acceptable. And here's a citation in their database. It's called Medline, that not only confirms the therapeutic relevance of natural substances in cancer treatment, but according to Sayer G, quote, blows the conventional approach out of the water. An article published in Planta Medicia, researchers found that an enzyme extracted from the pineapple stem, known as bromelain, was superior to chemotherapy fluorouracil in treating cancer in the animal model. quote, this is from the study, the anti-tumoral effect, bromelain, was superior to that of 5-FU, which is 5-fluorouracil, whose survival index was approximately 263% relative to the untreated controls, end quote. Mind you, that's from peer-reviewed literature, a major study, and yet no one knew about it. So what's so remarkable about this research is that 5-fluorouracil has been used as a cancer treatment for 40 years and has been relatively unsuccessful due to its less than perfect selectivity of killing cancer cells and often killing or irreversibly damaging healthy cells and tissues as well. So as a highly toxic fluoride-bound form of nucleic acid, uracil, a normal component of RNA, the drug is supposed to work by tricking more rapidly dividing cells, which include both cancer and healthy intestinal and hair follicle and immune cells, into taking it up and thereby inhibiting, meaning poisoning, RNA replication enzymes. Sounds a little complicated, but here we have bromelain, which is 100% natural. It is in that pithy part of the pineapple, not the part most people ever eat, but actually the part you should, because that's, you could juice it, you could put it in a blender, and that was better. So, add bromelain from pineapple. Now, you don't have to eat the pineapple part, the internal part. You could get bromelain capsules, standardized. You could put it in a juice, but anyone who has cancer should be using bromelain. I've been working with some people who are diabetic. And what I'm finding is they're diabetic and overweight and have heart problems, generally high blood pressure. They're all together, meaning when you are overweight and you have high blood pressure, there's a very high percentage of the time you're either diabetic or pre-diabetic. So when you start taking insulin, it causes further weight gain. That's the one thing insulin will do. It'll bring down your blood sugar, but it doesn't impact the cause of your diabetes. But it will cause you to gain weight. So I put people on a protocol where they're consuming no caloric food for the last 6 hours before they go to bed. But because they're hungry, I'm giving them things like lemon tea, which will help satisfy their appetite, and then liquid polyphenols, like concentrate from blueberries or pomegranate or raspberries, that are really flooding the DNA and healing the body. As a result, one woman who could not get her blood sugar, fasting blood sugar in the morning below 167, this morning it was 104. How such a radical drop, more than any drug could do. It is called overnight fasting. And it reduces blood sugar, but it also reduces, according to the University of California, the risk of breast cancer. So if you're a diabetic and you eat anything that's got a lot of calories in it or sugar in it late at night, that's harmful not just to your blood sugar. It precipitates a higher degree of breast cancer. So then I did a cross match in the literature, and sure enough, women who have diabetes have a higher risk of breast cancer. So, here is what the University of California has to say. Quote, and this was published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. And it was presented at the American Association of Cancer Research this week. A decrease in the amount of time spent eating and an increase in overnight fasting reduces glucose levels and may reduce the risk of breast cancer among women. Quote, increasing the duration of overnight fasting could be a novel strategy for reducing the risk of breast cancer. That was the Dr. Catherine Marinick on the study. Quote, this is a very simple dietary change that we believe most women can understand and adopt. It may have a big impact on public health without requiring complicated counting of calories or nutrients, end quote. So in lay language, what am I saying? I'm saying women who fasted for longer periods of time overnight had significantly better control over blood glucose concentration, which in turn helped prevent breast cancer. Now, we didn't know about the blood sugar cancer connection. You generally think of them as separate. All right, you want to prevent breast cancer. You have a lot of the isoflavones from soy or the polyphenols from berries. And diabetes, you want to keep your blood sugar down. Now we've realized that the higher your blood sugar, the more susceptible you are to breast cancer. But how do you keep that blood sugar down? You go longer without eating overnight. Now, most people eat right up until about the time they go to bed. And then they don't have that long period. So I'm suggesting your last meal be around 6 or 7 o'clock. And let's say you go to bed at 10, then you got 3 to 4 hours where you should have non-caloric food. Now, as long as you're having something that has no calories, the body still considers it fasting. As long as you're not raising your blood sugar, the body considers it fasting. So if you wanted to have some popcorn, popcorn doesn't have the calories, so that would be okay. But what I do is I suggest people take polyphenol drinks and herbal teas, and especially with lemon, and it kills the appetite. And now the body's got all the look, you got all the calories you need. You're not going to starve to death. You're not going to be, you may be hungry, but that's a conditioned response. But you don't need the food. You do not need to eat after dinner. There's no need in the world for food after dinner. It's our conditioning. Well, I'm watching television. I'm at a computer. I'm used to noshing. I'm used to snacking. I want to get something. You don't need it. So if you can just extend that, you can help prevent diabetes, spike in your blood sugar, and breast cancer. So that's good. That can save lives. Broccoli sprouts are a powerhouse of healing. According to the University of Pittsburgh, quote, broccoli sprout extract protects against oral cancer in this laboratory study and proved tolerable in a small group of healthy human volunteers at the University of Pennsylvania Cancer Institute. Now, this is not the first study to show that it was beneficial, but they're suggesting that people with head cancer, neck cancer, should be using broccoli sprouts. We would agree. And why? Because we know what's in the sprouts. I3C, indole for I, 3C for carbonyl, indole 3 carbonyl. And the isothiocyanates. These are natural chemicals that can kill cancer cells. So if you want to have a really healthy salad and help prevent cancers, or add something into your adjuvant therapy, then make sure that every day you have one box, which is a pint, of broccoli sprouts in your salad. Also, adding to the thousands upon thousands of articles showing the power and the importance of soy, we're talking about organic soy. We're talking about soy as a part of a larger, healthier diet that is multifactorial with nuts and grains and seeds and legumes and tumors and vegetables and juices and soy being but one part of that. This is from Georgetown University Medical Center. Quote, women diagnosed with breast cancer are often told not to eat soy foods or soy-based supplements because they can interfere with anti-estrogen treatment. But new research being presented at the American Association for Cancer Research annual meeting could eventually impact that advice because in animals, a long history of eating soy food boosts the immune response against breast tumors, reducing cancer recurrence. The study conducted at Georgetown Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center could offer good news to some women whose diet has long contain cancer. So, those who've been eating soy, good for you. you're on the right side of truth, science, and history. You're also getting Genistein, Genna, G-E-N-I, Stein, S-T-E-I-N. It's an isoflavon, and that stimulates the growth of disrupting cancer. It's very powerful. So that's why the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Koreans have so much less cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, than American women, because it is a part of their diet and has been for centuries. Now, you will hear some anti-soy comments. Go back into the archives about 7 to 8 years ago and listen to the one-hour debate that I had with the person who was an advocate of no soy. That person was funded by the Preston, Weston Price Foundation, which is a big advocate of meat and dairy and eggs. The doctors running around the country attacking soy were from the same foundation. That the scientific literature shows that a meat-based diet, an animal flesh diet, increases cancer. There are dozens of studies now on that. In fact, I have a new book coming out on that. I have all the latest science. I have over 360 studies on the dangers of meat and its relationship with cancers in the book. So soy, if it's organic and if it is a moderate part of an overall diet, can make a big difference. And just look at the background of those who are attacking soy with such a attitude. There is a bias, and it's just not being shown. Because when I ask the person on my show, have you now or have you in the past received money from a foundation that supports use of animal proteins? The person hung up and stopped the interview. I already knew the answer, but I want the audience to see when they come on, there is a bias. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Now we're going to take a break and come back, and we'll introduce you to part two of America's leading medical doctor who was pro-vaccines until she did her homework. And then she became just shocked at how bad the science of vaccines are. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll, on the road. We're in our second week of helping people live a healthier life, to de-stress, to appreciate the grounding, being able to put your feet on the ground and be close to nature. It's also helping because with this week, we were able to buy hundreds of premiums for the people on our sister station, WBAI in New York, and get them their premiums sent out. Those premiums, I believe, are being sent out last week and this week. Had we not done this, then there's almost zero probability you would have received your premiums in a timely manner or at all. So the sacrifice on everyone's part to make this happen was worth it. So now enjoy your premiums, and I'll be back shortly into the city. By the way, for those people who listen to this program over the internet. We have people all over the world listening over the internet. There are people who don't always have access to an internet, or maybe they're older people and are not comfortable using the internet, but they can listen on a land-based station. We're heard on stations all across America. But maybe you're traveling and you're not able to be at a certain time when that show's playing live. We have millions upon millions of minutes of people listening over a telephone. Now, here's the cool thing. You can dial a number and hear this show live anywhere in Canada and North America. So always have this number with you. So this way, like cab drivers or truck drivers or people on vacation or anywhere you want to be, you can just dial the number and listen. So write this down, please. This is your Listen Live telephone number, 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. And I believe that we're still number one in all of North and South America. Of nearly 5,000 radio stations, we're number one, people listening live. And in the whole world, I think we're in the top five. So that's good. Yeah, I just got word that we are number one. And I don't know how many total minutes, but I believe we're approaching somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 million. No, I just got word. They just told me 17 million. Wow, 17 million. I also want to thank the 25 million people who visited the site just to get information and articles. Now, I've been so busy in the last 3 days, I have not added anything new to my Facebook, but Jason, our program director who runs PRN in New York, he has had people working nonstop, putting hundreds of articles up, articles that are progressive articles from all over the world, because we have people getting information all over the world. So we don't do local issues. We do important issues that we are not getting covered in the mainstream media. So you can go to Gary Noll Facebook or Progressive Radio Network, and you'll get all these articles because we even hire people to work overnight. We have more articles we post each day than Al Jazeera, the BBC, and Huffington Post combined. And theirs is political. Theirs are ideological. Ours are not. So I just want to thank the people for all that. Okay? Our goal is this year to reach 1 billion people. 1 billion using the information. Listen now here from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on vaccines and what she had to face when she finally realized that her kidney patients who were getting vaccinated when they came into the hospital were getting sick and dying. And then when she did her research and found out that it wasn't happening if they didn't get the flu vaccine. And why were they getting this flu vaccine? This is part two of a six-part series.
One, I was idealistic and naive. I thought that those involved in policymaking, especially the ones whom I knew for years, would want to do what is best for patients over and above what policy dictated. How wrong I was. The hospital policy was to vaccinate as many patients as possible on the first hospital day. A pharmacist would go into the patient's room, show them one sheet of paper from the Centers for Disease Control with limited and biased information, and offer them two or more vaccines. If the patient consented, which most did, an order was put into the computer with the attending physician's name, often before the doctor had even seen the patient or a diagnosis had even been made, and the nurse would give that vaccine. Sometimes the order had my name on it, even though I would not have ordered the vaccine. I was not happy, and I decided to speak to the hospital management about what I was seeing. One day in the corridor, I bumped into the chief of medicine. He asked me how things were going, and I detailed my concerns to him. And according to him, I was the only doctor seeing these problems. He kept responding as if the science was settled. I got the full-on historic justification. Oh, but vaccines have eradicated smallpox, polio, meningitis. As if that had any relevance to vaccinating sick adults, some of whom were at death's door in the hospital. So I put my concerns in writing, and meetings were held to discuss the issue. But I wasn't invited to those meetings. The result? I was told that acutely ill inpatients would continue to be offered vaccines on arrival at the hospital. I asked myself, exactly what is the science that says that these vaccines are safe for really sick people? There must be studies on the subject and writings in the medical literature in order for these doctors to be so sure of the rightness of their policy. After all, it's science we're talking about, isn't it? And the science is supposed to be all settled on the safety and effectiveness of vaccines. Because the hospital policies were centered on flu and pneumonia vaccines, this was where my research started. I submitted a written report to the administration. In my research, I found that aluminum in vaccines is a documented cause of granuloma formation, something I had been familiar with for years. Aluminum is in the following vaccines: DTaP, some HIB, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, hepatitis B, all combination DTaP, HIB, Tdap, or hepatitis B vaccines, hepatitis A vaccines, and human papillomavirus vaccines. Aluminum and mercury given together have synergistic toxicity. My patients who received flu shots and pneumonia shots would have received both. Can patients be assured that their renal, interstitial, granulomatous, or autoimmune illness is not due to the aluminum or molecular mimicry from a previous vaccine? Moreover, I found that my patient population with acute and chronic illness had barely been tested for vaccine efficacy, safety, or long-term consequences. So the answer, of course, is no. Patients cannot be assured of safety. Some documented ill effects of vaccines upon kidneys include autoimmune kidney disease, vasculitis, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, and aluminum-mediated granulomatous issues. So I discussed all this evidence for over a year with the administration and with my various colleagues. Other doctors were starting to change their previously set minds, and a high number of nurses were catching on. But then, because the hospital administration could not rebut my arguments, they called upon an expert to set me straight. He never addressed any of my questions regarding acute kidney patients or acutely ill new admissions. He gave me a list of studies showing that some vaccines raise antibody levels in most immunosuppressed people with HIV or kidney failure. His argument was that ipso facto, for acutely ill kidney patients with sepsis, heart attacks, Guillain-Barré syndrome, cancer, urinary tract obstruction, nephrosis, and so on, vaccines were also perfectly safe. His letter was quite bizarre. I kept thinking, and this is the expert? Why can't he answer my specific concerns? Where is his proof that side effects don't happen to my patients? Nowhere could I find studies that looked at vaccines in acutely ill patients commonly seen by nephrologists. Even my pro-vaccine colleagues agreed that there was no scientific basis to give these injections so quickly upon admission, and they supported my motion to have the policy changed to vaccinate on discharge day. At the same time, the hospital turned up the heat on me. My progress notes and hospital charts were reviewed, which was something totally new to me. Nobody had ever before challenged my integrity or my patient care. I was then told by the administration that in order to support my outrageous claims, I should do my own study, a chart review study. I should submit it for peer review in order to prove it. But aside from doing one's own study, where would you initially go for case histories? Where I had just been, the medical literature, right? When I referred dozens of published case histories and expert peer-reviewed opinions to the hospital administration, I was told by the consultant that case reports in minor journals mean nothing. And even in major journals, case histories are just anecdotal. In his letter, the expert criticized my citation of non-American journals and that of my 47 medical references, one was from a Japanese journal. He insinuated that my argument about what I was seeing in my hospital was invalid because I searched the world's literature in order to make my point. He said that because there was no published data sets showing influenza vaccines caused kidney ailments, that my suggestion to exercise caution vaccinating acutely ill patients was unwarranted. The executive committee of my hospital also told me that it was not appropriate for me to stop vaccination orders on my patients and that I was confusing the nursing staff. I thought, how bizarre. Nurses are never used to the same treatment plan for all patients, ever. My experience was not one of confusing nurses at all, but of finding other vaccination-critical people on the hospital staff who agreed with me. Among the nursing staff, there were more allies than I would have ever imagined. Furthermore, the hospital administration argued that evidence for benefit of vaccination is overwhelmingly positive, and evidence from harm is negligible. Nobody in the hospital ever addressed my specific arguments. All I got was sound bites. Vaccines are safe and effective. Smallpox was eradicated by vaccines. Polio was eliminated by vaccines. After I left the hospital, this article by Dugal came out, as have several others which implicate flu shots in the genesis of autoimmune and vasculitic diseases. But in 2011, I didn't have this article. Even if I had put this in front of the executive committee of the hospital, their attitude was that the science was settled. Case reports mean nothing. Dugal's co-author told me personally that she is now taking vaccine histories on all her renal patients. All doctors should do the same, but it's rarely done because doctors have no idea about the immunology and toxicology involved in vaccinating. Dugal was saying what I had seen with my own eyes and reported to the administration, that an increase in autoimmune disease activity has been described after influenza vaccination, and he recommended careful assessment of the risk-to-benefit ratio, which I had done, yet the hospital overrode me and my expertise. Apparently, once a policy is established, professional opinion doesn't matter. Let's look at the cases Dugal described. The last two cases here are his, and the other ones are from the medical literature. There are patients with vasculitis involving the brain, lungs, kidneys, and intestines within weeks of vaccination, some of whom developed new diseases and some whom simply relapsed. Patients with vasculitis and underlying autoimmunity are not informed of the known risk to them in vaccinating. Instead, they're persuaded and reassured that the benefit outweighs the supposedly small risk and usually believe that the doctor knows best. Note the pattern here, though. Kidney failure 2 to 4 weeks after injection, requiring highly toxic drugs to treat these vasculitides. These were things I was seeing happen to some of my patients after vaccination in the past, and today I get messages from parents all over the world telling me how their child's kidneys became diseased after vaccines. And just last month, I got a note from a woman whose spouse with kidney disease, who was very stable, died at home one day after receiving two vaccines. She was extremely distressed, and I had no comforting words for her. Since leaving the hospital in 2011, more literature has been published besides Dugal that supports my hypothesis and my experience that common and difficult-to-treat kidney diseases can be caused and worsened by vaccine ingredients. This 2011 New England Journal of Medicine article titled "Early Childhood Membranous Nephropathy Due to Cationic Bovine Serum Albumin" details the association between circulating cationic bovine, meaning cow, serum albumin and a very difficult to treat form of kidney disease called idiopathic membranous nephropathy. Membranous nephropathy is a serious condition of the kidney filters in pediatrics and is more common in adults. Long-term prognosis is unknowable for certain, but approximately 50% of patients develop progressive kidney disease. The authors must be aware that they hit upon a very touchy subject since they implicate immunization in the body of the article, but conclude by simply saying, if bovine serum albumin is detected in kidney biopsy specimens, eliminating it from the diet could be beneficial. What the authors don't say is that eliminating direct injection of bovine serum albumin at the same time as injecting aluminum adjuvant may be beneficial in preventing the susceptible child or adult from developing this type of kidney disease. The following list of BSA-containing vaccines could possibly be very problematic to some people. BSA is used to feed the live animal or human cells that propagate the virus or bacteria during vaccine culture production. The implications of this article, in my opinion, are enormous in terms of potential adverse responses to vaccines that contain bovine serum albumin, but also to aluminum, viral, and bacterial antigens. How much adult or childhood nephrotic syndrome is caused by vaccine ingredients? The issue isn't addressed in medical literature. What clinicians see doesn't necessarily count. And how many of these vaccines are given at the same time? Often, 8 vaccines are given at once to children at 1 year of age, most of which contain bovine serum albumin and aluminum, which, by the way, is added to enhance the inflammatory properties of the vaccine to the vaccine antigens. Here are the aluminum-containing ones. The asterisk at the bottom indicates overlap of bovine serum albumin and aluminum. There's plenty of writing in the medical literature about how one-size-fits-all vaccine programs give variable results even in healthy people, and how they can trigger serious inflammation and autoimmunity. There's more reason, in my opinion, to believe vaccines are not only dangerous, but also less effective in sick people. For instance, one day when I was on rounds, I went in to check on someone who was having plasmapheresis, which is a procedure designed to remove antibodies from the blood. He had kidney failure, and when I saw he had just received an influenza vaccine, I was astounded, and I said to my colleagues and the referring physician who was with me, "Can you see the problem with this?" Well, everyone found somewhere else to look. Around the same time, I went in to see a 27-year-old young man with lymphoma and acute kidney failure who was in the middle of a chemotherapy infusion. And in front of him was the pink CDC information sheet for the flu shot and the pneumococcal vaccine, which he had just consented to. I said to him, "Have they given the vaccine to you yet?" And he said, "No." So I immediately canceled the vaccination order. These two incidents typify the events which were occurring at the time and were the clinical issues that set me on today's divergent path. If someone had just used logic and agreed with me that you don't vaccinate critically ill patients and accepted the evidence in front of their own eyes that the vaccines were causing problems, then maybe I would still be at the hospital today.
Pat, you were just listening to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, pro-vaccine, board-certified neurologist, board-certified internist, professor of medicine, teaching at a medical hospital until she started seeing the anomalies of her patients getting sick and dying, not because of the treatment for their kidney failure, but because of the vaccines given as a mandatory step without any science. When she challenged it, when she did her own homework, then they had no answers. Keep in mind, she has done more than 5,000 hours of research into the science of vaccines. She is a complete scholar. She is probably the most knowledgeable person I know in medicine on the subject of vaccine safety and efficacy. And as you heard her say, doctors are not doing their homework. Politicians don't do their homework. And most journalists stop at the homework that proves their point. Unfortunately, if you do enough homework and look at the full story, you come up with a different picture. Part 3 tomorrow. Now let's go over because we have two guests standing by. Robert Kennedy Jr. is an ardent defender of the environment and serves as the chief prosecuting attorney for the organization Hudson Riverkeeper and president of Waterkeeper Alliance. Earlier, he served as assistant district attorney for New York City. He's an advocate for the rights of South America and Canadian indigenous tribes. He has successfully strengthened treaties to protect their homelands. He is also a national proponent for vaccine efficacy and safety and consults for advocacy groups opposing unsafe vaccine ingredients, particularly mercury. And Robert has degrees from Harvard and law degrees from the University of Virginia and Pace University School of Law. And he's written for the New York Times, Washington Post, and Rolling Stone, etc. And his website is robertfkennedyjr.com. He is also the author, most recent book, Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak, Evidence Supporting the Immediate Removal of Mercury. He is joined by Robert Krakow in New York City. He's a trial lawyer in private practice and one of the nation's leading attorneys for vaccine-damaged children through the government's Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Now, he's handled almost every kind of civil and criminal case in all federal and state courts, and he is also a trial lawyer for over 30 years, and is a former Narcotics Bureau chief in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. He has founded several non-for-profit organizations advocating for the rights of individuals with special needs and is a renowned critic of the dominant medical belief that present vaccines are safe and effective. He is a graduate from George Washington University Law School and in the past served as the director of the Consumer Protection Center. His website is KRAKOWLAWFIRM, KrakowLawFirm.com. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Robert, I'm going to start with you. I'm extremely concerned about the vaccine bills entering almost 40 of the states, assemblies, and senates at this moment. And this was a preconceived and orchestrated maneuver. You don't have 100-plus bills pop up so rapidly out of thin air because of measles outbreak in Disneyland, which is now, according to officials, done with. And it's not unlike what we know about many other events. We have a horrible event, and then suddenly there's an overreaction. Think of the Patriot Act as a reaction to 9/11, and where Congress didn't even read it. They were uneducated on its consequences. It only, and yet it ended up impacting people. So give us your understanding of what's happening with this media blitz of the pro-mandatory vaccine advocates like Paul Offit everywhere. Everywhere in the media you turn, he's there. And he's not just saying that we need mandatory vaccine. He goes out of his way to engage in personal and ad hominem attacks against parents who have children who've been injured without giving any credibility to over 1 million parents who have injured children from vaccines. Could you share your insights, please?
Well, I agree with your assessment of this, that this, you know, about the way that the industry has orchestrated, has parlayed 159 measles cases, which is a rather garden variety annual measles outbreak, into over 101 bills in 36 states that I know of that are designed to end these vaccine exemptions. And the, you know, the reason that people, if you look at all the studies, the reason that people are vaccine hesitant, most of the people who are vaccine hesitant, first of all, are people who have intellectually disabled children. Paul Offit, you know, denigrates them as anti-vaxxers and anti-science and naturopaths and conspiracy theorists. But when you hear the word anti-vaxxer, or the term anti-vaxxer, you should think of somebody with an intellectually disabled child, somebody who has a child who is vaccine injured, who they believe is vaccine injured, and they are reluctant to give the same vaccines to perhaps his younger siblings because they think that those kids may share the same genetic vulnerability. And they just certainly don't want to give more vaccines to the child who was injured. And yet, if you get rid of the philosophical exemptions, it would require them to do just that if they want to put their children in school. The reason people, other than, these are people, by the way, who are educated. All the studies show that. They've read the science. They've gone online. They've networked with each other. They understand that, you know, for example, mercury, in vaccines, mercury is a potent neurotoxin that has been associated in hundreds of scientific studies, peer-reviewed studies in the published literature, with a suite of neurological disorders that are now epidemic in American children: speech delay, language delay, ADD, ADHD, hyperactivity disorder, ASD, Asperger's, and autism, and others. And what, you know, you hear the CDC talking points that mercury's been taken out of vaccines, which is not true. Kids today can get, because of the flu vaccine and because of trace amounts that remain in many of the pediatric vaccines, kids today can get the same, virtually the same exposures as they were getting prior to the removal of thimerosal from the pediatric vaccines in 2003. The real problem is that CDC is a troubled agency. There's been four separate federal studies now by the United States Congress, a three-year study by the Senate, by the Inspector General of HHS, and by the Office of Research Integrity last year, which show that, which paint CDC as a cesspool of corruption. And there are two of the two divisions of CDC's, or two departments of CDC's vaccine division that are affected. The first is the division that adds new vaccines to the schedule. Now, when I was a kid, I got five vaccines. Today, my kids the younger kids got 69 doses of 16 vaccines. The change began in 1989. The vaccine schedule was changed, and the reason it was changed was for economic reasons, because in the 2 years before, Congress passed rules that made it, that gave immunity to Big Pharma for injuries caused by vaccines. So all of a sudden, vaccines became pharmaceutical pay dirt. Before that, they hadn't made a lot of money because there were injuries and the pharmaceutical companies had to compensate. But now they couldn't be held responsible, and so there was no check and balance of the lawyers. The courts were taken out of the process. You know, I now have a product that if you can get it onto that schedule, it's like you're hitting pay dirt. You're hitting a gold mine. You're hitting the oil well, because you now have the federal government ordering hundreds of millions of people to buy your products, and then it's being sold to hundreds of millions around the world. There's no advertising, there's no marketing, and you have no liability for lawsuits. And so some of these vaccines are worth $1 billion a year to these companies, and you would hope that the panels that vote those vaccines onto the schedule would be kind of geeky, lab-coded scientists who are concerned only with public health, but unfortunately, that's not true. They are vaccine industry insiders, and they're making money on putting these vaccines on the schedule. And I'll give you an example, because you were mentioning Paul Offit. Paul Offit, in 1999, sat on the panel that added the rotavirus vaccine to the schedule. At that time, he was working on his own rotavirus vaccine. He didn't recuse himself. He voted to add it. The rotavirus vaccine that they added killed 103 people in its first year, and it was pulled from the schedule. And then Offit's rotavirus vaccine was added to the schedule. That made that vaccine a bonanza for him, and he sold it to business partners sold it to Merck 5 years later for $182 million. Offit giddily told Newsweek magazine that it was, quote, like winning the lottery, end quote. Well, according to the 2008 Inspector General's report from HHS, 97% of the people who sit on those panels have the same kind of conflicts that Offit does. In other words, they have financial benefits from getting a vaccine under the schedule. So now they've added 69 vaccines to the schedule. We don't really know whether they added it because they think it's good for public health or because it's good for their pocketbooks. And there are 271 new vaccines in CDC's bureaucratic pipeline that are likely to be added to the schedule over the next few years. And Paul Offit has publicly said that he believes a child could take as many as 10,000 vaccines. So this is just blue sky for Wall Street. The other division at CDC that's relevant, and I'm going to shut up because I want to give Bob Krakow, who knows more about this than I do and is really smart and eloquent, a chance to talk. But the other division of the vaccine department at CDC is the immunology safety division, and that is where the scientists are the research scientists who are supposed to determine vaccine safety and efficacy. And we've known for years that they were lying and manipulating data because the shoddy junk science that was coming out of that department and the fraud was patently obvious. And I read science. I'm an environmental attorney. I'm not scared to read science. I've argued and won hundreds of cases. Almost all of them have scientific contention. So I'm used to dissecting junk science, and this isn't even good junk science. But in August of last summer, the senior scientist at that division, Dr. William Thompson, invoked federal whistleblower protection and hired the leading whistleblower attorney in the country, and spoke on tape saying that he had been ordered, he and the other scientists and his colleagues at CDC had been ordered for 10 years by Julie Gerberding, who was the former director, who now is, and went to the, matriculated to the vaccine, had it run the vaccine division, the $5 billion vaccine division at Merck. And Frank DiStefano and Colleen Boyle, that those overseers ordered the scientists at CDC to lie, to manipulate data, to massage data, and to bury data, to conceal the links between thimerosal exposure and neurological injuries in children. And so, you know, you have all of the checks and balances of our democracy that have now been subverted by Big Pharma. Big Pharma is a $1 trillion industry. Vaccines are $30 billion a year. They want to raise it to $100 billion. And they are the number one lobbyists on Capitol Hill. They spend twice what oil and gas spends, which is the next biggest. The regulatory agencies, so the politicians are not protecting us. The regulatory agency has been completely captured. CDC and FDA are sock puppets for the industry they're supposed to regulate. They're really just wholly owned subsidiaries of Big Pharma. You have the lawyers, the courts, and the judges that have been excluded from the process. That should be a check and balance. And you have the press, because pharma is now the number one, by far, advertiser in newspapers and network news. The president of a network news division told me recently that in some months that pharmaceuticals are 70% of the revenues of the news division. So the news divisions have become vessels for selling pharmaceutical drugs and platforms for pharmaceutical propaganda, and they will not let voices like mine or Dr. Humphreys or Dr. Krakow onto the air. Paul Offit will not debate any of us. He will not debate anybody publicly. He's got so many vulnerabilities, and we're not allowed. I can't publish in news. You know, I can publish, go on virtually any program I choose to talk about other environmental issues, and I can publish editorials in virtually any newspaper in this country. But there is no newspaper in this country that will allow me to publish an editorial about vaccine safety. And that includes not just the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, but it also the so-called alternate press, like Salon, Slate, Huffington Post, Mother Jones. People who understand what's happening cannot talk about those issues, and it's this kind of Kafka-esque cocoon that really is frightening to somebody who has always believed in American democracy.
Robert, hold your thoughts, because we do want to bring on Robert Krakow now, and to get his point of view as well. Thank you. That was extremely well articulated. Robert, can you speak about the constitutionality of vaccine mandates? And Mary Holland has appeared on this program many times, as have you in the past. And since vaccines are by law defined as unavoidably safe, they therefore technically remain at an experimental stage. And the science is very clear that vaccines are not safe and their efficacy is questionable. And moreover, vaccine drift or shedding is becoming a serious problem. Consequently, vaccinated people are infectious to others for some period of time, which should put an end to any illusion about the reality of the theory of herd immunity. So if the science favors the view that vaccines cannot be proven safe for a given individual, then what legal basis does the medical vaccine cartel have for mandating vaccines for all?
Yes, thank you, Gary, and thank you to Bobby Kennedy, who's become a terrific spokesperson for our children throughout the country. I think I want to go back to your reference to the orchestrated effort to impose vaccine mandates and eliminate any exemptions. This is a gross overextension of what the state of our law is. First of all, start with the premise that it's the policy of our nation that vaccine injuries occur. The leading case of authorizing vaccine mandates is Jacobson versus the United States. You've probably heard this before. That case stood for the idea that there should be a balance in exercising vaccine mandates. What we have now is essentially a permanent public health emergency called by the government to eliminate mandates when, in fact, we don't have that emergency. Many of the vaccines that are mandated are not ones that are contagious diseases, hepatitis B, tetanus, and others. We have no declaration of an emergency for many of the vaccines. We have a trumped-up situation where there was a limited number of measles cases, and all of a sudden, even though vaccination rates uptake is at all-time highs, it hasn't decreased, we have this campaign to eliminate mandates, which I believe was orchestrated by the vaccine manufacturers, who have no fear of immunity at all, see this as their major profit sector, emerging, probably growing, and in the future, with the 200 or more vaccines in the pipeline, a profit sector. So we see a distortion of what the law should be. The law should be balanced. We have an emerging science, we could call it adversomics, where we know that some people are more susceptible to vaccine injury than others. If you put that in context with the idea that our government recognizes that vaccine injuries occur, how can you not have exemptions? And yet we have this push, and we know that there are government organizations allied with pharmaceutical industry, vaccine manufacturer organizations for this orchestrated push. How can you not allow exemptions? How can you not allow families to make a choice about what goes into their children's body or their own bodies? You know, most of the vaccine injury cases we're seeing over the last couple of years are flu shot injuries. A lot of adults are getting injured. And we see a campaign to mandate adult vaccines that's emerging also. This is all very troubling. I think that we have to get our courts to revisit the idea of exemption, of individual choice, and to place a balance. We should not have this permanent state of public health emergency where every vaccine, for whatever purpose, is mandated with no exemption. That's what the latest push is for, and it's very troubling. And we have, what I'm seeing, though, is parents, ordinary citizens are rising up to resist this. Not that they're resisting vaccination. And most of the parents, as Bobby Kennedy pointed out so eloquently, most of the families do not question this because they have an ideological resistance to vaccination. Certainly that's not the case for me. Most families are questioning this because they've experienced a problem with vaccination. So it's a product of experience and not ideology. I think the government's approach to this, which is mandating vaccines, ridiculing, demonizing people who challenge vaccination as a one-size-fits-all policy, is actually undermining the vaccine program in this country. Because there's nothing that will engender distrust more than a draconian policy that does not allow for exemption. So I know you asked me about constitutionality. I question the constitutionality of the proposed legislation. I think it's imbalanced. I think it needs to be challenged. I think it's a gross exaggeration of what the state of the law is that stemmed from 1905, and we need to revisit that.
Well, both Robert Kennedy and Robert Krakow, we're out of time. Thank you both for all the good work you're doing, and we look forward to more conversations. And this forum is always open for those who have an enlightened opinion who wish to share it. Thank you both.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Gary.
We're out of time, everyone. This discussion will continue tomorrow. Have a nice day.